This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Avatar director James Cameron was just in the Amazon, meeting with tribespeople who will be displaced by a new dam slated for the deep jungle. It's the Belo Monte Dam on the Xingu River, an upstream tributary. Flooding at least 400,000 square kilometers of forests and farms, if built, Belo Monte will be the world's third largest dam. Though the Brazilian courts recently ruled against it, the government has forged ahead, already awarding the construction contract. No one doubts the Brazilian people need more power, and they don't need the emissions and cost of coal or oil imports. The giant metropolis of Sao Paulo has gone dark or browned out many times. If South America cannot power its cities, the exodus to cut down the Amazon may be worse. Brazil also hopes to expand their electricity-hungry aluminum industry. And yet, everything about this mega dam project doesn't make sense. As we learn from Amazon Watch, quote, the National Amazon Research Institute calculated that during its first 10 years of operation, Belo Monte would emit 112 million megagrams of CO2 equivalent, equal to the CO2 emissions of 2,156,000 passenger vehicles per year, end quote. When all is said and done, the Belo Monte Dam will add to the climate change that already threatens to dry out the Amazon, not to mention the lost species and the impact on the weather of not just Africa, but the whole planet. And during the long months of the dry season, this dam will hardly produce much, dropping to 10% of its rated capacity for 3 to 5 months, unless the Brazilian government builds another 5 damaging dams upstream to feed the complex. If the drought of 2005 returns, the project will fail, just as the electricity system of Venezuela is failing now due to lack of rain and runoff for hydropower. We're going to hear about that, with notes on our recent climate conference in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Against the big picture of the drying Amazon, our guest is Nicholas Kozloff. His new book is No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Maybe after the movie Avatar, more people will care about the Amazon and its people. Maybe. Scientists have been worried about the world's great rainforest for a long time. Called the lungs of the planet, some hear the last gasp coming if the Amazon succumbs to human pressures and global climate change. We'll investigate all that and more with Nicholas Kozloff. He's written about the politics of the region in a 2008 book, Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left. Now Kozloff's latest is No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Nicholas, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
It sounds somewhat impossible to most of us that the great rainforest could dry out, so let's dive in a bit gently with real-world events in Venezuela. There's a huge underreported story going on there. You've said that President Hugo Chavez may be facing his Katrina moment. Tell us what is going on.
In recent months, there's been a very severe drought in Venezuela, and this has affected the water levels in Venezuela's hydroelectric dams. The most important hydroelectric dam, the Guri Dam, supplies, I think, about 70% of the electrical power in the country. And Chavez himself has blamed the drought on the El Nino meteorological phenomenon, which is associated with the Pacific Ocean. El Nino has different kinds of effects in different parts of the Pacific Basin. In Peru, it results in flooding, whereas more inland, it can result in droughts. So I think, in part, Venezuela's energy crunch right now can be attributed to El Nino, although there are probably some other factors, for example, a lack of government investment in the electrical sector. One of the points that I was trying to make in the article is that it's rather ironic because you think of Venezuela as an energy powerhouse, and how could it be that Venezuela itself could be experiencing these problems?
Well, that's something I really admire about your article, something that makes me more likely to trust your writing, because despite much admiration for some good work Chavez has done, you point out that the emperor's clothes are all paid for by planet-killing oil exports. It's almost true that Chavez Venezuela is as much of a climate wrecker as the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, would you say?
Right. I would say it's rather ironic because Chavez has been deriding affluent countries of the global north for their consumeristic lifestyle. And yet, Chavez owes much of his meteoric rise on the political world stage due to oil. I mean, the head of OPEC for a couple of years was Ali Rodriguez, a Venezuelan, actually a colorful character who was a communist rebel in Venezuela and who became Secretary General of OPEC, and he was a big price hawk in OPEC. So as a result, you know, Chavez benefited from the high price of oil, and he's used that oil largesse to extend his geopolitical influence both in South America and Central America. And also, you know, ships discounted oil to poor communities in the U.S. So he certainly benefited from the high price of oil. So it's a little ironic that then he would turn around and say, and then deride affluent countries for being consumeristic when he's certainly, that's been the strength of his geopolitical power. The other point I was making in the article is that you could make the argument that Venezuela, not just Chavez, but over the course of the 20th century, through its exports of oil to the tune of millions and millions of barrels of oil, has contributed to global warming. If that's true, then perhaps that in turn exerted an impact on the El Nino effect, which scientists believe may be getting more intense and more frequent as a result of global warming.
But not all South American leaders feel that way. Some are beginning to question it. I noticed that in December last year, the UN announced a trust fund to pay Ecuador to leave oil in the ground in Yasuni National Park. And wasn't there a statement by another South American leader about leaving oil in the ground or gas to save the climate?
Well, I'm not sure of the last point, but certainly there have been some innovative proposals from the likes of Ecuador and President Rafael Correa. His proposal is called the ITT Yasuni proposal, and there's a pristine national park in the Ecuadorian Amazon, because don't forget, the Amazon touches on many countries throughout the region, the largest being Brazil and Peru, but also Ecuador, Venezuela, Colombia, Bolivia. And so Correa's innovative proposal suggests that in exchange for not drilling for oil in this Yasuni National Park, that Ecuador be reimbursed to the tune of several billion, I don't know exact math, but billions of dollars. And I think that that's an excellent proposal and worth looking at and considering. Nevertheless, I would say that a lot of the leaders of the so-called New Left in South America are a little caught up in this resource nationalism, and Correa is no exception, even though he had that interesting proposal. Chavez, Correa, and even Evo Morales in Bolivia, they're all caught up in this, enmeshed in this resource nationalism and extracting raw materials, and that in turn has set up a contradiction with the very people that propelled them into power, you know, the indigenous people that want ancestral rights over their lands and don't want the oil exploration. So as long as these leftist leaders fail to resolve this inner contradiction, I think it could set up a difficult political confrontation for them.
Well, I guess this is a good time to talk about the alternative climate meeting in South America. It's had about 1 inch of mainstream press here in North America, practically no TV time. Can you briefly tell us what that summit was about?
Many leaders in South America, Evo Morales included, have criticized the Copenhagen Climate Accord, I think it was back in December, for being inadequate and failing to address the needs of the countries of poor countries in the South, which are fighting to adapt to climate change and are really caught in the crosshairs of climate change, I think, to a greater degree, say, than nations of the North. And so Morales, who's actually been a kind of a Johnny-come-lately to the environment, nevertheless had this excellent idea of launching this alternative summit in the city of Cochabamba. And basically the idea is to press for deeper emissions cuts, for clean energy transfer, to address environmental refugees, and also, perhaps most provocatively, pushing for a climate justice tribunal, which at this point is rather symbolic. Oh, and also a referendum on, a global referendum on passing greater emissions. And so a lot of these measures are, I think, somewhat idealistic and some might say more symbolic and moral in nature than actually yielding practical results. But I think Evo Morales is trying to cast himself as the moral spokesperson on climate change. And I think, notwithstanding his resource nationalism, which hasn't always had protection of the environment in mind, I think Bolivia has some moral standing on the environment because, you know, indigenous people in Bolivia have had their glaciers, have witnessed glaciers melting, and so they're paying the price for the global north in action.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with author Nicholas Kozloff. Let's get to your new book, No Rain in the Amazon. First of all, can you orient us a bit? How big is the Amazon and why does it matter to the rest of the planet?
We're talking about a vast area. It's the same size as the 48 contiguous United States. So imagine just from Vermont to California down to Texas. It's just vast. It's 40% of the South American continent, bordering on many countries. Like I said before, Brazil and Peru, for example, have the largest swaths of Amazonian rainforest. And those are the two countries that I concentrated most on in the book. And I went down there, you know, interviewed scientists, environmentalists, and the like. But, you know, borders on many countries. So this is by far the biggest component of our deforestation problem. There are other rainforests. For example, you have Indonesia, Sumatra, Democratic Republic of Congo, but the Amazon is by far the most important component. My point in the book is to essentially say that while many people were concentrating on the Amazon in the 1990s, you had a number of celebrities like Sting and others going down to the Amazon to halt hydroelectric dams and the like. And all of that, I think, is very important. The point of my book, though, is to point out the climate component, because the Amazon rainforest has a lot of carbon stored in the vegetation and trees. And so when you have deforestation, that results in CO2 emissions. And I think people far too often pay attention to the transport sector and other causes of global warming while ignoring the tropical deforestation.
I vividly recall photos in 2005 of wide mud banks where rivers used to run and the general drought in the Amazon. What do we know about that?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. I actually went to the jungle town of Iquitos in Peru and down in the Amazon, which was right in the crosshairs of some of that drought. And so I spoke to many witnesses. That was an interesting drought because usually drought in the Amazon is associated with the El Nino phenomenon, which rises out of the Pacific Ocean and which has a drought-like effect on the Amazon. But the interesting thing about the 2005 drought is that, according to scientists, it didn't have anything to do with the Pacific Ocean, but warming currents in the Atlantic. So that was a real warning shot to, I think, many people in the region because, you know, El Nino is a naturally occurring phenomenon, and now it may be accelerating and becoming even more intense through global warming. But if you add on to that warming currents in the Atlantic having impact on the Amazon, then that is certainly a matter of grave concern. And the 2005 drought occurred in a really strange region. It was in the western Amazon, Peru, down in Bolivia, and that's usually doesn't suffer those kinds of severe weather events. So it kind of caught a lot of people off guard, and a lot of people were displaced. And, you know, much of the transport in the Amazon is by boat. And so if the river dries out, you're just stranded. And in addition, you know, you got a lot of wildlife, for example, the manatee, which is an aquatic mammal, dying out as a result of the drought, and, you know, just tons of fish being left on the banks of rivers. And so this is an ominous sign for the future.
Well, as you know, not everyone agrees with the Hadley Center prediction that, they said that temperatures could increase by as much as 18 degrees Fahrenheit and rainfall dropping by as much as 60% by 2100. That's from the Met Office in the UK. But there have been 9 other studies, I understand, ranging from agreement with that prediction all the way to the Lawrence Livermore study suggesting the Amazon will take up even more CO2 in 2100 due to stimulated plant growth. What makes you adopt the drying scenario?
Many prominent scientists who have studied the issue, for example, Philip Fernside, who's American, who's been working in the city of Manaus for 25, 30 years, and he's the most cited scientist on climate science in the Amazon, and another guy by the name of Lovejoy, who advises the president of the World Bank, who's a very recognized expert in the field, have warned about the possibility of drying out. And fact is, if you have consecutive El Niños, and El Niños becoming more frequent, the Amazon will dry out, and some prominent scientists warned that you could get a savanna-type environment, which wouldn't result in a desert in the Amazon. But if you have a change from a rainforest to a savanna, that's going to have severe repercussions. You could have impact on world precipitation. You have less precipitation, for example, in the central U.S. as a result of the Amazon collapsing. And that could have a lot of economic ripple effects on agriculture in the U.S. So I think there's enough reason to be concerned and enough scientists warning about this. And I think maybe we can't say the definitive word about it, but I think enough experts have warned about it, and it's worth really considering.
I've seen other studies which suggest there may be a tipping point in that Amazon basin based on the amount of rainforest that remains. At some point, there isn't enough left to keep the cycle of rain and cloud creation going. What are the main forces reducing the size of the rainforest?
Okay. In my book, I break that down pretty systematically. Deforestation is a social, economic, and political problem. And the causes of deforestation vary depending on the country. In Brazil, you've got a lot of powerful economic interests, including agribusiness, the biofuels industry, and landless settlers that are actually being pushed by a lot of these powerful economic interests. In Peru, you have less powerful economic interests, and there it tends to be more the timber trade and actually, interestingly enough, a coca leaf for cocaine production. But I guess my point is that the U.S., I'm trying to direct this book a lot to an American audience and people in the global north. And my point is that, you know, while a lot of these issues are social economic problems rooted in South American societies, the United States, you know, through its backing of the Inter-American Development Bank and other, and by also by buying tropical commodities, you know, contributes to a lot of these problems. So in my view, in order to solve this problem, it's going to require a massive collaboration between South America, North America, Europe, and it's going to have to be a radical redesign and reorientation of the Amazon, which might sound ambitious, but I think the alternative would be just an incredible carbon spiral downward and potentially a drying out of the rainforest with severe repercussions.
So we've got soy being grown for animal feed. We've got things like, well, just plain hamburgers coming out of beef from the Amazon. So what can we do as consumers, perhaps, to help preserve this Amazon rainforest?
You mentioned soy and cattle, which are kind of go hand in hand together. Those are two chief drivers of deforestation in Brazil currently. And the reason they're linked is because, you know, cattle has become internationalized. When you talk about cattle ranchers in Brazil, maybe people think have this idea of just some guy out in the middle of the Amazon and a low-scale production. But these companies are hugely international now, billions of dollars. So they're exporting the beef and products made from beef all over the world. So it could be in the upholstery in your car through leather. It could be in your hamburger. And then soy, when people hear about soy, they may think that, oh, that's tofu. That's what I eat in the Japanese restaurant, or edamame or something, and when you eat it in the appetizer in fancy upscale restaurants. But, you know, the fact is that now soy is being used as soy meal to feed animals. And this is a huge international problem now because the Chinese that want to ape middle-class lifestyle think that it's a status symbol to consume meat, and all of that meat has to be fed with the soy meal. And so a lot of that soy meal is going to China and also to Europe. But as far as your question, we have to, well, one thing you could do is require green standards for the tropical commodities that get consumed in the global north. But I would go further. I mean, I think you might just consider abolishing the cattle and soybeans, and that would be very tricky politically and would require, I think, massive collaboration between the global north and global south, a massive bailout to the tune of tens of billions of dollars per year to create agroforestry and other better alternatives in the Amazon that would preserve the rainforest and not result in carbon emissions, as opposed to the agribusiness. But that has been discussed, but so far the U.S. has not stepped up and really taken this issue on seriously.
What do you see as the most promising international initiative to try and preserve our climate by saving more of the Amazon?
Well, I see it as the reducing emissions through deforestation proposal. This has been gaining some traction in international meetings and events, and yet the funding and many other mechanisms have proven inadequate so far. And I think, well, basically, the idea is that that the global north would pay Brazil, say, to stop deforesting the rainforest in light of the fact that it can't get its emissions under control. Now, that's a little strange when you think about it, because the global south didn't create this problem historically. You know, most of global warming got accelerated as a result of industrialization since the late 18th century. And that was, Europe, Russia, the U.S. And so you would think that it's their responsibility to do it. So it's a little problematic from a moral standpoint to then say, well, the global south should solve this problem. Yet, if the reducing emissions through deforestation proposal can put real money into this problem and save the rainforest, then I think it could be beneficial. The only thing is that it would have to be massively rethought, because right now the World Bank is handling some of the money, and I think that's a total mistake, because the World Bank has historically funded boondoggle environmental initiatives in the Amazon, hydropower and cattle and such. So I don't think the World Bank should be in charge of those kinds of funds. The other thing is that any reducing emissions through deforestation proposal would have to solve social inequality and do environmental protection, and that's very ambitious. If you don't solve both at the same time, it's not going to work. So what do I mean by that? You've got to resettle all those landless squatters in Brazil, but you've got to do it outside of the Amazon, because right now what the government is doing is resettling those people inside of the Amazon on state land, and that doesn't solve the problem. But, the Brazilian government, which is run by President Lula, who, to his credit, has had some positive environmental proposals, but he's compromised by agribusiness, and he doesn't want to resettle people on, private land outside of the Amazon. That's a problem. So you're going to have to totally rethink land reform and handle all of these complex issues, and you're going to have to find other viable economic pursuits for people in the Amazon, such as sustainable crops such as Brazil nuts, or a medicinal plant for pharmaceutical purposes, perhaps local handicrafts or sustainable ecotourism. And so all of this would have to be funded to the tune of tens of billions of dollars by the global north if this is to be at all serious.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Can you give us your website so people can follow up on your work?
Sure. It's nikolaskozloff.com. That's nikolaskozloff.com.
Thank you. Our guest has been Nicholas Kozloff. Look for his brand new book, No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Thank you for being with us, Nicholas.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
How can I still be surprised when mainstream media tells another big lie or squelches an important story? And yet a couple of whoppers last week left me with jaw dropped again. After the government-backed assassination attacks on Toyota, the rival to government-owned General Motors, we were treated to an all-out top-down media blitz on the sudden success of GM. Headlines and newscasters proudly announced the local boys just paid $6.7 billion back to the American government and another $1.3 billion or more to the Canadians, 5 years ahead of schedule. Wow, General Motors cars are selling like hotcakes. Billions of dollars in profits must be rolling in. We see President Obama and his team self-congratulating and more airtime from the GM CEO, Ed Whitaker, saying, "We're back and we're the best. Yippee!" Except, It was all the big lie you hardly heard about. Much as I hate to cite Fox News or Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, it seems confirmed all those billions came not from big sales or profits, but right from the back pocket of taxpayers. Again. In a shell game for the ages, TARP man Neil Barofsky confirmed GM used Treasury funds squirreled away in a bailout fund to pay out the loans. It's like saying, hey, I paid $50,000 off on my mortgage, but putting it all on Visa. In fact, GM has lost more billions over the last quarters, totaling $4.3 billion in losses since their bankruptcy last July. Their next financial statement for the first few months of 2010 isn't due out until May, but sales are probably around 25% of what they were in 2007, which is great news for the atmosphere. If we really cared about our grandchildren, we wouldn't build another single oil-burning car. The world is already overpopulated with gas guzzlers. Still, shuffling billions in taxpayers' money and calling that success, that's an impressive con game, even by later American standards. Meanwhile, the Canadians play their own. Of course, you heard that climate scientist Andrew Weaver is suing a Canadian newspaper and several denialist journalists for libel. No? Well, maybe that's because the story has been censored in most Canadian media. I had to find out about it from a Radio EcoShock listener in Australia, where the story was republished from the Guardian newspaper in Great Britain. Andrew Weaver is a real climate scientist and a lead author of the 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was viciously attacked by a right-wing business newspaper called the National Post, especially by a hack called Terence Corcoran. In four newspaper articles and subsequent virulent comments, Weaver was accused of cherry-picking climate data in order just to keep his research money coming. These articles also claimed that there had been no increase in annual global mean temperatures and that climate models are, quote, falling apart. Weaver told The Guardian, if I sit back and do nothing to clear my name, these libels will stay on the internet forever, end quote. And he's taken the unusual step of demanding the National Post arrange a retraction from the various denier websites that used their attacks. The newspaper, he says, endorsed attack sites by linking to their reprints of the articles. Apparently, you can't just make up lies about climate scientists and climate science and get away with it anymore. I've found news of this lawsuit in the overseas press, in the government-owned CBC, and in various blogs, but nothing about it in my local newspaper, even though Andrew Weaver is a well-known professor at the University of Victoria, not 100 miles from Vancouver. That is because Canada suffers from a horrible media monopoly known as CanWest. Established by the Asper family, CanWest owns both major newspapers here in Vancouver, plus a television station, and dozens more major newspapers across Canada, including the National Post. So when the newspaper chain is accused of libel, of printing things that are claimed to be grossly untrue, most Canadians don't get to hear anything about it. I call that censorship. Meanwhile, CanWest went bankrupt and the newspapers are up for sale. We can only hope the new owners will kick out the stable of climate deniers that have filled up so many pages with anti-science opinion and we love our tar sands hysteria. A vain hope, I know, but that's all we've got left. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.